Hey, next on the T Nation, thanks for coming back and tuning in to part two of this week's show featuring one of my all-time favorite guests, Bob Friend Jr., a guy who's been a friend of this show going all the way back to season number one, and a guy who's become very important to me over the last 9 months or so, and that is two-time winner on tour, David Peoples. Bob Friend always tells it like it is. No sugarcoating on what Bob thinks about what's going on around the game, what he saw at the U.S. Open, plus a whole lot more. David Peoples makes every segment that he is a part of so much fun to listen to and such a joy for me to be able to be a part of as well. So sit back, relax, let us take your mind off everything else going on in your life for the next hour or so. Before we get started, I want to remind you about our friends over at 2Under. 2Under men's performance briefs are the unofficial underwear of the PGA, Ryder Cup, and President's Cup teams and are sold in over 3,000 golf pro shops and golf specialty retailers nationwide. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, they are David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom. Go to 2under.com to check out the bundle specials that offer substantial discounts for being a Next on the Tee listener. That's the number 2UNDR.com. 2Under, performance in your pants.
Every January, PGA Tour Superstore pros meet every manufacturer, learn about the latest equipment, log thousands of hours of training, and together hit over 100,000 balls, all so they can get you the perfect fit.
All right, now back, and I'm honored to say this, for the 19th time with me here on Next on the Tee is obviously one of my all-time favorite guests, Bob Friend Jr. Bob has been a great friend going all the way back to 2013 when he first joined me on the show on episode 3, and we're over 800 episodes later, so that tells you what a great friend and how long he's been a wonderful friend here on the show. He's from my hometown of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, played his college golf at LSU. He helped them win the 1986 SEC Championship. Bob had 11 career top 10 finishes when he was in college. He won the Western Pennsylvania Amateur Championship in 1984 and 85 and the Pennsylvania State Championship in 85 as well. He turned pro in 87. He played out on the Korn Ferry, PGA, and Champions Tours. He had 5 top 10 finishes his rookie year out there on the Korn Ferry Tour. Got his first win at the 1991 Fort Wayne Open. In 1998, Bob won the Panama Open and he finished second in the Canadian Open. Over the course of his career, he finished in the top 10 27 times. In 2003, his high school, Fox Chapel, inducted him into their Hall of Fame. And if you're a baseball fan, you're going to remember his father, Bob Friend Sr., who pitched in the major leagues from 1951 to 1966. And he helped the Pirates win the 1960 World Series over the New York Yankees. And I am very privileged I get to have Bob back with me again here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Bob, how are you, my friend?
Chris, I'm doing great. Your introductions are always fantastic. And you're right, Bruce Devlin's one hell of a guy. I played with his son, Kel, in college, and we also competed a little bit as a professional. So Kel was a wonderful guy, and his dad's a legend.
Bob, I want to get your thoughts. I've been asking everybody tonight, kind of reflecting back on what we saw at the U.S. Open, particularly in that final round between Rory and Bryson. What was going through your mind as you were watching how that back nine unfolded?
Shock. I mean, when you go and you take a look to see that, you know, what Rory has dealt with, you know, his big Achilles heel has been his putting. And then obviously, you know, he putted so well during the course of the week. And then only really to toss away the golf tournament on 16 and 18. Look, I mean, it's the pressure is immense. But at the end of the day, this is not a guy looking to win his first major. It's a guy looking to win his sixth major. I was shocked. But that said, you know, Pinehurst is one of those golf courses where I played there. I played in the 1999 U.S. Open when Payne Stewart won. And the golf course was different then. All of the quote-unquote wiregrass areas were all U.S. Open rough. But I can tell you, you know, we watched Bryson DeChambeau drive the ball a little bit loose. And he got an awful lot of good breaks out there, which is part of what you have to have when you're winning a golf tournament. The up and down on the 72nd hole from Bryson DeChambeau is one of the greatest up and downs I have ever seen anywhere. So hats off to Bryson DeChambeau. And, you know, a little bit heartbroken for Rory, and life rolls on.
And let's talk a little bit more about that, Bob, because that 2-3 footer that Rory had on the 18th had a lot of left or right break in it. Now you're standing over a putt that's probably going to win you the U.S. Open. For those of us that are out there with our buddies or playing in a club championship or something, even just locally, that's a pretty tough putt when it gets in our head. I don't know. What's your thoughts about what you saw from Rory and how he reacted over that putt and how he stroked the putt?
Well, I can tell you, I mean, I've not had the opportunity to win the U.S. Open, but I had the opportunity to win the Canadian Open in 1998. And on the 72nd hole, Billy Andrade, who we played together for the last 2 days, he made about a 35-foot putt on the 72nd hole. And then now I had come out of a bunker and I had to make a putt. I had to make about a 4-foot putt to tie him. And I can tell you, I couldn't spit. My knees were knocking. I couldn't hear. My ears were ringing. I couldn't breathe. I thought I was going to black out. And somehow I rattled into the hole. Taking a look at the putt that Rory had, obviously it had a lot more break in it than a lot of people realized. But the tendency for a right-handed player on a putt that works from left to right is that the putter has a tendency to shade towards the hole as opposed to swinging towards your target. So as a right-handed player in a left to right breaking putt, you've got to be really committed to your spot, and you've got to make sure that putter head swings towards your spot, which is obviously left side of the hole or just left of the hole, as opposed to the putter just kind of swinging towards the hole. And that is a tendency for right-handed players on left to right putts. Again, the hard thing, you know, the putt at 16 was to me, it was shocking. When he missed it, I think I actually physically gasped. The putter at 18, you know, we're going back, we're taking a look at it, had a little bit more break in it than maybe all of us thought. But, you know, I mean, the pressure is immense. But again, this, you know, Rory's been there. You know, this wasn't the first time he was trying to win a major championship. This would have been his sixth. So I was a little bit shocked at his finish, to be quite honest with you.
You mentioned Bryson's shot on 18, that 50-yard bunker shot. It's being hailed as, like you put it, one of the greatest shots, one of the greatest up and downs in major championship history. Do you agree? Is that long bunker shot? Is that the toughest shot in golf?
Well, I think that when you combine the 55 yards out of soft, very, very soft, sugary, powdery sand. I mean, the sand at Pinehurst is very, very soft. That's a really, really difficult shot. Then you combine it for, I've got to get this up and down or we're going into a playoff. I mean, literally pressure pack level of difficulty is 9.9 out of 10 when you're playing with your buddies. It literally is going to go down as one of the great finishing shots in championship golf. There's no doubt in my mind. I was like, oh my God, look at this thing. So yeah, I think that all credit is due to Bryson. You know, he won his first U.S. Open at Wingfoot in 2020 when, you know, it was a COVID year. To come back here and have the great crowds there at Pinehurst, hats off to him. He really earned it.
He's gone from a player that a lot of people really didn't like just a year or two ago to now one that people are calling he's the people's champion. What do you make about his personality turnaround?
I think that basically he's played up to the crowd. I was happy to see what he did afterwards. I know that he stayed late into the night, signed all the autographs, let his emotions come out. And that's what the fans want to see. They want to see somebody that they can relate to. But again, I he's playing on the LIV Tour, which is unfortunate. Hopefully the PGA Tour and these guys can get this thing all wrapped up. We can start seeing all the great players in the world all playing in one place at one time. But, you know, I'll be honest, I wasn't a big fan, but I was very impressed with him the week of the U.S. Open. I really was. The way he interacted with the galleries, the way he let his emotions on his sleeve. I mean, I think that's what the public wants to see.
One of the other things we've been talking about tonight is Scottie Scheffler becoming the first player since Mr. Palmer in 1962 to get 6 wins in a season before July 1st. Do you think he could be the next generational player? Could he dominate the game like Tiger did?
I don't. You know, Tiger Woods is cut from the same cloth as Jack Nicklaus. You know, Arnold Palmer, I mean, everybody talks about what a statesman he was, but Arnold Palmer won 62 times on the PGA Tour. I mean, Scheffler has accomplished so much by the age of 27, and the year that he is having, it's remarkable. He switches putters, and next thing you know, he goes from, you know, a great ball striker to a guy that should have won a bunch of golf tournaments to a guy that is winning everything. And I think I like what Bruce Devlin had to say was that he's winning on all grasses. He's winning on all types of golf courses. When you go and you take a look at Tiger Woods, when you go and you take a look, you know, Jack Nicklaus didn't really start playing well on Southern grass until he moved to Florida in 1970. Scottie Scheffler is winning on all types of golf courses, all playing surfaces. And, you know, look what he did at the PGA after that debacle in the morning to go out there and shoot 66. I mean, it shows the guy's got mental toughness. I am really, really impressed by him. He's a really solid guy. And again, obviously, he just, you know, he hits these iron shots that are just better than anybody else. And now he's finally figured out the putting. So I think that, you know, for Scottie Scheffler, I think the sky is the limit.
Speaking of Tiger, what are your thoughts on the new ruling that gives him a lifetime exemption to playing essentially any golf tournament he wants for the rest of his life?
I have no problem with that whatsoever. I mean, Tiger Woods, you know, the reason that we're all playing, the guys are all playing for this enormous amount of money is because of Tiger Woods and what he has brought to the game. I think that if we are living in the era of Jack Nicklaus, you know, being 48 years old, I think that Jack Nicklaus being offered a similar exemption, I wouldn't have any issue with that either. I mean, Tiger Woods didn't move the needle. He is the needle, and he is responsible for this enormous resurgence in the game of golf. I have no issue with it at all. And anybody that does, you know, remember who basically baked this cake for everybody. And I think that you take a look at his physical limitations, he's not going to be playing out there every single week. He can't do it. But I have no issue with that whatsoever. I think it's a draw, and I think it's an honor that's well deserved.
You mentioned Liv a moment ago, and obviously Bryson playing on that tour. What are your thoughts about where we're going with this thing? It seems like the PGA Tour and Jay Monahan want to tell us all the time that there's progress being made and things are moving in a positive direction. Meanwhile, Jimmy Dunn resigns, saying there's no movement happening. And it seems to me the more that Bryson wins or more that guys on the Live Tour come over and win major tournaments, the more and more leverage that Yasser Al-Rumayyan is going to have. It feels like they need to get a deal done pretty quickly, or I'm afraid where this thing could end up, because, like I say, Al-Rumayyan is just getting more and more leverage every time something like that happens.
Well, I agree. And I think that, frankly, I'm a little bit stunned, and I'm not. Well, I am kind of I'm actually kind of surprised that Jay Monahan still has a job with the PGA Tour. I know Jimmy Dunn. Jimmy Dunn is as solid a businessman you'll ever meet. They just have to get this to come together. And I can tell you this. I mean, Fred Couples made a wonderful statement. He said, name a single Live player that went over to play that tour and would have done it if no money was offered to them. They are playing 54 hole events. They are playing in shorts. They've got music pounding out there. And yes, in some of these smaller markets, this is what the people want to see. But you go and you take a look to see what their television coverage is. They're on the CW. Nobody is watching these tournaments. And I think that if you go and ask those guys, they would much rather be back here playing 72 hole events with world golf ranking points available, as opposed to doing that. But the fact of the matter is they've got these long-term contracts. They've got this big money that they chase. And, you know, we're just going to have to get this thing figured out, because these bifurcated competitions is just, it's not good for golf.
Bob, switching gears a little bit. The last time you were on the show, we talked about the restoration work that Gil Hanse did there at Oakmont. So as we look ahead to next year's U.S. Open, which is going to be held there, talk about the things that we're going to see and that we can look forward to.
Well, first of all, the golf course was lengthened from 7240 to 7431. And having been a member there for over 50 years, I can tell you one thing that I'm certain of. I have seen hole locations at Oakmont that nobody has seen for 80 years. We had a little bit of a saddle effect with all the bunkering around the green complexes. When Gil Hanse came in to do the renovation, he looked at aerial photographs and photographs all over the place from 1925 to 1938. The founder died in 1938. And then anything after that era, Gil Hanse did not look at. So what he did was he took a look at each individual hole in that time frame and said, all right, this is the best version of that hole during that time period. And I think you're going to be really, really amazed by what you see, especially the comparisons. There's a lot more motion in the fairways. There's a lot more strategy off the tees. But most importantly, what you're going to see is you're going to see green complexes that we really have not seen at Oakmont for over 80 years. Hans did not touch any of the interior portions of the greens, the storied greens at Oakmont. But what he did was he using photography, using computers, he went in there and he eliminated the saddle effect. And we picked up, oh my gosh, the 13th hole, there are hole locations that are going to be unbelievable. And I think the golf course is actually going to play more difficult. Everybody's very familiar with all the trees we've taken out at Oakmont. It looks like it should look, which is how the founder intended. But I think that the big difference between Oakmont and Pinehurst is that Bryson DeChambeau and guys driving the ball a little bit loose with the driver are going to be greeted by 5 to 7 inch rough off the fairways. And the Oakmont rough is not this beautiful bluegrass rough. It's a blend of bluegrass, rye, poana, and fescue. And the ball always goes to the bottom. If we get situations where the week is dry, like as it was in 2007, I know that the greens starting the day will probably be starting to roll around 15.5 on the stip meter, which is what they did in 2007. And if it's dry, I think you're going to see scores similar to what we saw in 07, where Angel Cabrera won with 5 over par. It's going to be very, very entertaining. And, you know, the USGA has this as an anchor course. We're going to host many major championships there over the next 25 years. And it is going to be, it's going to be a real treat, especially when the people see the contrast on television with this is what the golf course looked like in 2022. This is what it looks like now in 25. So it's going to be really, really entertaining.
Bob, just a couple more before I let you go. I'm going to switch gears to more local stuff there in Pittsburgh. As a Pirates fan and an LSU alumni, how excited are you about what you're seeing from Paul Skenes?
Well, Paul Skenes is a freak. I can tell you that when we drafted him, I played in the Pittsburgh Pirate Alumni Golf Tournament the following week, and I was talking with Steve Blass and Rick Rushel. And I said, what do you guys think of this pick? And they were both dead serious. They said, this kid is a cross between Roger Clemens and Tom Seaver. You know, last year I watched the LSU win their seventh national championship. Skenes in the World Series, complete game on his 125th pitch, he threw it 104 miles an hour. He's got 5 pitches. The ball moves all over the place. They range from anywhere from 84 to 104. He's got a big ass. He's got big legs. He doesn't do anything crazy with it. And he literally, I mean, you take a look where he is in strikeouts. I think he's the second in the league, second in the major leagues with rookie strikeouts. Pirates have a very, very good starting rotation. We're a little bit weak in mid relief. And we got to wake up the bats a little bit. But Paul Skenes has really breathed life into this team. And every time the guy pitches in Pittsburgh, you've got 30, 32,000 people go out there to watch him pitch. Very exciting.
Speaking of the bats, Bob Nutting may be the most hated owner in all of sports. He recently said the Pirates need to take advantage when they have an opportunity to make the playoffs, which is what they've got in front of them right now. And to your point, right, the pitching staff is performing very well, but they're dead last in the National League in batting average, next to last in on base percentage, and they've struck out the most. Do you think he's going to allow Ben Sherrington to go out there and get a bat and give this team an opportunity to do something?
I think he will. I think he will. I think that this kind of harkens back to, you know, 2014, 2015, 2016, when the Pirates had the opportunity to get into the playoffs and they were in the wild card. And you go and you take a look to see that, you know, PNC Park was packed. I mean, this town is so starved for good baseball. It's been over 30 years since the team has been competitive on a regular basis. I think he's going to have Charrington go out there, pick up a bat. I think that, you know, you take a look at it. I mean, McCutcheon obviously is at the end of his career. You've got Brian Reynolds is hitting the ball really well. You know, they have to get a little bit more production out of O'Neill Cruz. Strikes out a lot. You know, the other day hit a ball into the Allegheny River on a fly. But at the end of the day, you take a look at those batting averages. They're not really getting the job done. You know, Connor Joe was on a very nice stretch there, but he has kind of cooled off a little bit. But they're going to have to pick up some offense here if they're going to remain competitive.
Bob, before I let you go, remind our listeners what you're doing now and how they can follow you online and on social media.
Well, I managed the Squirrel Hill office for Howard Hanna. Howard Hanna is the largest family-owned real estate company in the United States. And we're the third largest real estate company in the United States. And we have offices across 13 states. We're members of leading real estate companies of the world. I have my broker's license, and I manage 65 agents. And you can follow me on HH Real Estate MGR Bob Friend on Instagram. And if anybody's looking for a house in any of the 13 states or anywhere in the United States, give me a call at 412-576-3444. We'll hook you up with a great agent.
Bob, you're the best, my friend. I can't thank you enough for coming back and being a part of the show again this week. You're absolutely one of my all-time favorite people on the planet. And I can't wait. Like I said at the top, you've been on the show 19 times now. I'm looking forward to making it an even 20 very soon.
Well, Chris, we're going to have to get you out to Oakmont this fall. Is that a deal?
It is a deal. You kidding me?
We got to get you out to look. You're going to be doing your show. We got to make sure you know what you're talking about when you get out there to the big course. So we'll talk. And we'll see if we can hook something up in September.
Sounds good to me, my friend. I'm ready to go whenever you're ready.
Polish those clubs off, dust off those golf balls. Let's rock and roll.
I'm in. Bob, right, we'll talk soon. Take care, my friend.
Bye, buddy.
See ya. That is a great Bob Friend. And again, look, one of the great grinders of all time out on the tour. I've heard so many of his peers talk about nobody worked harder on his game than Bob Friend. And again, that's not from one guy. That's not from two guys. That's from dozens of guys that he played alongside of that have been a part of this show. He is very well thought of in the golf community and has been for decades. And then on top of that, what a wonderful human being he is. So I can't thank him enough for being a part of the show as often as he has. And you kidding me? Am I going to be at Oakmont in September? You're darn right. You tell me when to be there and I'll have the plane tickets, the golf clubs, everything's going to be shined up, spiffied up. And I can't wait to get out there to see that golf course. Just fantastic. I hope that invitation comes very, very soon. Coming up next is a guy who has become a wonderful friend so far in 2024. He's been fantastic on his two previous appearances. And that is former two-time winner on the PGA Tour, David Peoples. Before I bring Peeps into the show, let's talk about our friends over at Squares Golf. And folks, do you sway and you're off balance in your golf swing? You know what? It could be your shoes. A golf shoe needs structure to provide stability and reduce sway. How can you tell if your shoes lack structure and are hurting your game? If you can hold your shoes by the toe and heel and twist it, toss it. Squares was designed for the perfect balance of structure and comfort. Isn't it time you tried Squares? Try the new Speed Bolt at squares.com. That's squairz.com.
Frustrated with your golf game? Imagine playing with total confidence. Join me, LPGA Pro and golf mindset expert Debbie O'Connell, for my Conquer Your Golf Mind Challenge. Bill cut 6 strokes and Lori is club champion. What's your goal? Click the link or text NEXT to 727-339-0106. Use code NEXT for $20 off. Your tee time for transformation is now. Will you take the shot?
Okay, now back with me is a guy who has quickly become one of my favorites here on the show since he first joined me back in December, and that is David Peoples. Let me remind you about David's background. He's from Augusta, Maine, played his college golf at the University of Florida from 1979 to 1981, where he helped the Gators win the Florida and Dixie Intercollegiate Tournament. His teammates include a great friend of this show as well, Mark Calcavecchia. They teamed up together. What a dynamic duo they must have been. In 79, David won the Florida State Amateur. He turned pro in 81. He was the medalist at Q School in 1989. He won twice out on the PGA Tour at the 1991 Southern Open and the 92 Anheuser-Busch Classic. He also won the 1990 Kapalua International, and he did so by 5 strokes over Davis Love III. Over the course of his career, in addition to those 3 wins, he had 4 runner-up finishes, 5 third-place finishes, 23 top fives, and 37 top tens. And I couldn't be more excited I get to have him back with me this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Peeps, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, Chris. Thanks. Great to be on with you again.
So, David, tonight we've really gone back and taken a look at the U.S. Open, and I got everybody's feedback about what they saw. What'd you think about what you saw in the final round?
You know, I thought the golf course, it's got all the history and everything. And the way they set it up, it looked like it was a very tough test. It looked like when they hit it in the rough, you know, those little clumps, I thought they'd get stuck in those things, but they seemed to bounce off like a pinball, you know? And so they were able to, you know, get their club on it, you know, going into the green. And I was surprised by that. What happened at the end, I mean, Bryson DeChambeau just, he did some awesome things. You know, getting the ball up and down from the places he did so many times, you know, 6-footers seemed like tap-ins the way he was going. So it was very enjoyable to watch. You know, I was pulling for Scotty again. I've just gotten on the Scotty bandwagon quite a bit lately.
I'm guessing you stood over a couple thousand 2 to 3 footers over the course of your career. How agonizing was it to watch Rory's putts on 16 and 18 not go in?
It was kind of a shock, really. You know, I don't think he's really missed anything from that short of a distance. I felt terrible to, you know, see that happen to him. Understandable why he, you know, got in his car and just sped away. It takes a little while, I think, when you get, playing in those little tournaments like, you know, it used to be the BC Open up there where they played the Dick's Sporting Goods. I think I finished and missed a 1-foot putt, and I absolutely tried. I missed it. It was the last hole of the golf tournament. And so I had to chew on that for, you know, a few days.
But so yeah, to your point about that of what happened and how the thing played out, Rory leaving has kind of rubbed me wrong. I mean, yeah. I get that you don't want to relive what happened to the media, and I get that piece. But to not go up to Bryson and congratulate him, kind of the sportsmanship of that, and say, well played. Right. I mean, that's Mr. Palmer wouldn't have done that. Jack Nicklaus wouldn't have done that. Tiger Woods wouldn't have done that. But for Rory just to watch that putt go in and then turn around and grab his clubs and leave, to me, kind of left me disappointed.
Yeah. And when you looked at Bryson, what he did, he was on the range, you know, when he was going up against Xander and the PGA, and same type scenario. Xander makes the putt and Bryson went over to find him coming off the 18th green and shook his hand. It was a great show of sportsmanship, no doubt. I think Rory could have done the same. But I know what it feels like to not in anywhere near that level. But, you know, sometimes you just don't do the right thing.
Going back in your playing career, David. You played, I believe, in your first U.S. Open in 1993 at Baltusrol. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. It was very forgettable.
What was your impression of playing in the U.S. Open? Was, you know, that being the first time around and the USGA and the setup and how hard they always make the golf course? What did you think, at least when you were out there playing in practice rounds, about what a U.S. Open setup looks like?
Well, when I went there to that particular U.S. Open, I wasn't playing well at all. I was really struggling. I used a new putter that I'd never even tried before just to cash in, really, to be honest. You know, they wanted a putter in the U.S. Open, so I said, oh, I'll do it for you. I'm going to shoot 80 anyway, the way it felt, you know. So, yeah, the U.S. Open is just the ultimate test. You're not going to – if you're searching for your game when you get there, you're going to be leaving pretty early.
You got back into a U.S. Open in 2001. This time it was at Southern Hills. How great was it to make your way back into a U.S. Open 8 years later?
Well, that was really nice because I qualified in Memphis, Tennessee there and 36 holes, and then, you know, made it and was able to get in the car and drive the 5 hours over to Tulsa. So that was really cool. And it was a grind, though, the whole time. And I think I got it up and down on the 36th hole to make the cut on the nose. And you know, the weekend wasn't so hot. I had a late tee time, not off the right tee, but I did have a tee time. But I was laying in bed watching the guys play, trying to look at where the putts were breaking. And I picked my pillow up, put it behind my head, and, you know, just wrenched something in my back. So that added the challenge to playing in the U.S. Open that year.
People may not remember, but in that 2001 U.S. Open on the 72nd hole, Stewart Cink missed a 2-footer that ultimately cost him a spot in a playoff because Retief Goosen had 2 putts to win from 10 feet, He runs his first putt 2 feet past and misses it coming back, which resulted in he and Mark Brooks being in a playoff. Were you still around the golf course? Did you stick around to see how all that went down?
No, I did not. I'm not sure where we were off to the next time, but I had the family along and I had to get everybody organized of who was going where and all that sort of stuff. So I wasn't able to stick around for that.
I'm looking ahead to a little bit later on this summer. We've got the FedEx St. Jude coming up in mid-August, so we're a couple of months out from that. You've played in that tournament several times. You had the first round lead in 2000, and you ended up opening up that first round with a 65, and you live right there outside of Memphis in Germantown. What was it like for you to go out and play that well in front of the home crowd?
Oh, it was great. It really was. Back in the old days when they first built that golf course, they had bent grass greens. And it was very easy to score. You mean it was like, you know, hitting your ball into a mud puddle. It would just not bounce off, or it would stick right where it hit. And, years after that, I ended up getting paired with John Cook. And that was the year he shot some record number. I think he was maybe 24, 25, maybe even 26 under for the week. And when they changed that, it was more of a pars were like a U.S. Open, really. Turned it into that kind of course. But I did my damage, I think, when they still had the bent grass greens, and it was great to do that around all the people there in Memphis.
When you look back at your career, where are the favorite places, favorite tournaments that you always enjoyed and look forward to playing at?
I always liked going to the Bob Hope. You know, it was a pro-am, and it was kind of relaxing and beautiful golf courses out there in Palm Springs area. Always enjoyed that one. The LA Open at Riviera. Really everything out there on the West Coast, maybe with the exception of Pebble Beach. Just never did figure that place out. And then of course Memphis and some of the, I can't remember all of them, but some were good for me and some weren't so good.
What was it about Pebble that you didn't like?
Mainly the shooting 80s and 81s and stuff like that.
Was it the wind? What was it that was killing you?
You know, I would just freeze on shots. I mean, like number 10 is a fairly, you know, straightforward par four right down the hill. You know, if you had a good drive, you're going to come in there with maybe a 9-iron or a wedge. And I could have a wedge from the middle of the fairway and I'd hit it on the beach. You know, it was... And it just got in my head really, really bad. And I thought, man, this is... So I stopped going there. I stopped going there maybe after the first five or six times, you know. And then I went back for an off-season event. It wasn't the AT&T, but it was still at Pebble. And, you know, the rotation of the golf course was the same. And I went out there and I went, this is ridiculous. I got to get everybody to come back out here. I forgot how pretty this place was. And, you know, and so I went ahead and played and same old stuff. So I quit going again. But what a beautiful place. That had to be, you know, the nicest course on the tour, but people never looked at me and thought, how can you not like this? It's like, well, it's a competition. You know, I'm here to try to do good. And it was just a struggle.
You were in the 1990 and 91 golf card sets the Pro Set put out. What was it like the first time you saw yourself on a trading card?
That was pretty darn cool. Really, really neat thing they did there. I think they came out with three cards. Matter of fact, I still have the red, white, and blue shirt that hanging in my closet because it was.
Is that right?
Yeah, I still have that, and that's what I was wearing on that card. So, believe it or not, people that are card collectors and stuff like that, they'll send. You know, I'll get two or three envelopes, you know, every month or every, you know, 3 weeks or so, and asking me to sign it. They're a fan of golf and how much they love the game. And, you know, so I keep sending them and they keep coming. It's funny.
Does it amaze you at all that how valuable something becomes once you sign your name to it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I didn't realize what was really kind of going on there. I thought, wow, you've really hit the big time here. But then I looked it up and I thought, oh, they got this many David Peoples cards for this. And they're over here for that. And that one's 99 cents. And I thought, okay, it was a rude awakening, but it was cool. I love reading the little letters that they send with the cards, you know, asking you to sign and everything like that. So it's become a lot of fun to look forward to getting them.
Do you search your name out there on eBay to see what David Peoples paraphernalia or memorabilia, I guess I should say, is out there?
I kind of stumbled on it once. And so, you know, that kind of opened my eyes to what really was going on. And it's okay. I'm fine with it. You know, like I said, mine was 99 cents. My card was 99 cents.
When you were playing out on the PGA Tour, what was a great pairing for you? Who did you enjoy getting out there and teeing it up with?
Well, if I was playing with one of the real famous guys, you know, I think Fuzzy was probably the easiest guy to play with. Ben Crenshaw, I thought would be that way, but he was just a tough competitor, you know, and he just, I think he shot 65 and I shot about 77 or 8 at the old Western Open up at Butler National. Remember that? I'd have to go with Fuzzy as my all-time favorite, for sure.
When you first got out on tour, did you seek out any of those famous guys, any of those legends to try to help you understand what life was going to be like out on the PGA Tour and how to deal with it?
You know, I wish I would have, but I didn't, and went through some, you know, kind of some lonely times out there and stuff. But more importantly, I wish I would have, you know, picked their brain or tried to get into a practice round setting with them and, you know, and learn some of the things. I mean, I watch golf all the time now, and I've learned so much just from watching the telecast, and especially when Faldo was on there. He wasn't necessarily my favorite, you know, but he really broke down a lot of things, and you could really learn a lot listening to him.
When you watch an event nowadays, do you just sit back as a fan and watch? Like when you're watching Scotty or the guys that are out there playing really well now, are you a fan or are you a player kind of critiquing and really getting into what they're doing and how they're doing it?
I'm a little of both. I'm probably more of a fan because I'll sit down with my wife and she really likes, I can just tell by the body language if the ball, where the ball's going, if it's, you know, if it's right or left or something like that. She just thinks that's the greatest thing. So, you know, but yeah, I do try to pick up on stuff, even though all I can do is, you know, hit a wedge for about 15 minutes now these days, but it's always interesting to, you know, see the different ways guys go about, you know, hitting their shots. And I enjoy it both as a fan and as a player.
Do you miss being out there?
Yeah, big time.
Yeah,
definitely. I don't care to watch the Champions Tour so much because, you know, that's where I wanted to, you know, be at this stage in life. But I definitely watch the young guys.
You mentioned just a moment ago that you can barely hit wedges now. Is it a physical thing or you just haven't played that much?
Yeah, you know, I got diagnosed back a decade or so ago. It was arthritis. You know, you get arthritis with age and stuff. And I guess all the repetitive motion of hitting so many golf balls, you know, got that. And there's really not a lot they can do for arthritis. So, you know, it really slowed my swing speed down. And I think, you know, now being 64 years old, my swing speed is way back there in the rearview mirror.
It's interesting you mentioned that because I recently went to the doctor because I've got some aches and pains in my knees and ankles and lower back, and they did some x-rays and the doctor said to me, he's like, you're what, 58, 59 now? I said, yeah, I turned 59 back in April. He's like, well, welcome to your late 50s, early 60s.
That's right.
That's what you're going to get.
That's so, right. You know, and you're like, hey, somebody should have told me this back in the day.
Exactly. David, before I let you go, let our listeners know what you're up to now and how they can stay up to date with all the great things you're doing.
Well, not much really. You know, I get on Facebook every now and then. You might find me there plunking around, you know, looking at golf swings or stuff like that. But retired, my wife retired about 2 months ago. And so we've got a little place down in Naples now. And, you know, there's a ton of golf courses down here. So I'm trying to worm my way on a couple of them.
I might know a guy, so let me know when you're ready to go out there and play. I might be able to set you up.
That sounds good, Chris.
David, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come back and be a part of the show. You're awesome and absolutely have become one of my favorite people on this show. So I hope we get the privilege of catching up with you a little bit later on in the year.
Well, absolutely. Anytime, Chris, just give me a call.
I appreciate you, David. Take care. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
All right. Same to you, Chris. See you.
See you, David. That is a great David Peoples, folks, and just a wonderful guy. And like I say, this is the third time I've had the privilege of having him on the show since December. and just instantly became one of my favorite guests. He's just so much fun to talk to, and his stories are good, and he's just as genuine and honest as you could possibly be. And you can't ask for anything better than that out of a guest on the show. So he's had a lot of great experiences, played a lot of great golf over the course of his collegiate and pro careers. And hopefully we get the privilege of having him back on the show, picking his brain a little bit later on in the year. And I can't thank him enough and wish him the best with he and his family now that he's down there in the Naples area. And I do know a guy or two that could probably get him on a golf course whenever he's ready to get out there. And our good friend, Tom Patry, down in that area. So maybe we can hook those two guys up. But David's fantastic. I look forward to catching up with him again soon. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this edition of Next on the Tee. I want to send out my sincere thanks to Rob Strano, Bruce Devlin, Bob Friend, and David Peoples for joining me this week. Scheduled to join me next week are, speaking of Tom Patry, he'll be back with us as he is every other week. Plus, we'll get our regular monthly visit from Dr. Bob Winters. And making his Next on the Tee debut is going to be Keith Scioli. Keith is the founder of Golf Live, which powers virtual golf lessons. So I'm really looking forward to hearing about their technology and the great things that he is doing. So it's going to be a fun show. I hope you'll come back and join us. Quick reminder that you can find this show available as a podcast just about anywhere you get your podcast content. But in particular, we're out there on the Pittsburgh Tribune review site. Just go to triblive.com and click on sports. You'll find the most recent episode right there on the homepage of the sports section. If you click on sports and then podcast, you'll be able to listen to any of our shows from this season. You can also find the show out there on Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audio Boom, Player.fm, all over the net. But my thanks to the folks also over at Good Pods for making this show one of their recommended podcasts. So please download their free app and stream your favorite podcast right there on your favorite device. But as I say every week, most of all, my sincere thanks to all of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate you guys so very much. Until next week, hit them straight, my friends.
Coming down the mountain, I take a breath of sand. Can't tell the day or time, but I know this day will end. On a mission I can't